Welcome to KUOW Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this episode, we hear all the time about the social political divide in the United States, mostly from the comfort of our respective bubbles. When Berkeley-based sociology professor Arlie Russell Hochschild realized the extent to which she didn't understand the experience of right-leaning Americans, she decided to do something about it. She chose to embed herself in Lake Charles, Louisiana, for an ethnographic experiment. The result of her five-year-long series of excursions is her book, Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning on the American Right. Hochschild spoke about her experiences and takeaways with University of Washington political science professor Christopher Sebastian Parker. Their conversation took place on February 12th at Seattle University's Piggott Auditorium as part of Town Hall Seattle's Civics series. KUOW's Sonia Harris recorded their discussion. Please note, this recording contains unedited language of an adult nature. We're presenting our podcast version here. To listen to the full event, go to kuow.org/speakersforum. Here, Town Hall Seattle's Ware Harmon introduces the event.
Arlie Russell Hochschild is a professor emerita of sociology at the University of California, Berkeley. She's the author or editor of 9 books, many of which have been named New York Times notables for their respective years and cultural moments, including The Second Shift, Working Families, and the Revolution at Home, that's from 1989. 2003's The Commercialization of Intimate Life, Notes from Home and Work. Global Woman, Nannies, Maids, and Sex Workers in the New Economy, edited with the very same Barbara Ehrenreich, who will be joining us in a few weeks' time. And 2012's The Outsourced Life, Intimate Life in Market Times. Her latest book, Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning on the American Right, is a finalist for the National Book Award and will be the subject of our conversation in just a moment. Christopher Sebastian Parker is a professor of political science at the University of Washington and a frequent and valued figure on the town hall stage. His last book, Change They Can't Believe In, The Tea Party and Reactionary Politics in America, won the American Political Science Association's award for best book on race, ethnicity, and politics. And he has two upcoming books that need your attention. The Great White Hope, Donald Trump, Race and the Crisis of American Politics. That's coming from University of Chicago Press. And also White Fright, Racial Progress and Racial Retrenchment from the Civil War to Donald Trump is to follow. Cheerful stuff coming from our friend Christopher Sebastian Parker. Please join me in welcoming him and Arlie Russell Hochschild.
Ooh-wee. A lot of people here tonight. Well, it's my distinct pleasure to sit here with Professor, I'm just going to call her Arlie because I can't pronounce her last name. I'm having a hard time with that. Not to put you out there too much, but I read her stuff when I was an undergrad, so been an admirer for a long time. So welcome to our conversation, and her book, Strangers in Our Own Land, clearly a landmark book. I mean, it's really well read. It's extremely well written. Had a chance to read it on the plane a couple of weeks ago for the first time. It's really worn out right now, but I learned a few things. Arlie will say is that, she learned something from my book too. That would be very nice. And so
came out first too, by the way. So he was on top of the game. I just confirmed him.
And we just came at it from different, methodological perspectives. She's a more qualitative researcher and I'm more of a quantitative type. And it's always good, in social science when you have this conversion, right, using different methods. It certainly gives me more confidence in what Matt and I found, and hopefully, it confirmed what she found as well.
That's true.
You want to say anything in a way of
opening? Oh, I'm delighted, absolutely delighted to be here, and loved your book.
Thank you.
And felt that, we really found the same thing. I just dug deeper into one place, and yours was more the overview. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sure we'll find something to disagree about, but.
Well, given the time we spent in the green room, I thought we have actually less to disagree about than I thought. So, but we'll try to give you guys a good show. So. So I'll begin with a few softball questions. The pitchers will start up at about 70 miles an hour. They'll get to about 100 by the time I get to the bottom of this tablet. So let me ask you first, Arlie, what was the purpose of the book?
The purpose of the book actually shifted on me a bit. In 2011, I had a moment in the sociology department in my office at UC Berkeley, and in this kind of blue bubble, and realizing that there was a big split, that so many things that I wanted to see happen and I've written about over the years weren't going to happen. If nobody believed in government, if the government said being part of the problem, not the whole, part of the solution, not the whole solution, but if people didn't see it, if they saw it as the enemy, oh man, nothing could happen, really. So I thought, I better look and see what this is, this growth of the right. So that was the first purpose. Mm-hmm. So what's going on? I don't get it. And then what I realized is that nobody I knew kind of knew anybody who was really hardcore Tea Party either, and that I was in a bubble. Mm-hmm. And I had to get out of that bubble and just turn my alarm system off. You can do it. You can turn it back on. And try and climb an empathy wall into another world, another truth, people who live in a different truth. And so that was the first purpose. But after 5 years of ethnographic work and going to pig roasts and eating a lot of fried food going fishing with people and hanging out looking at graveyards and schools, go to church, and coming back and writing this, I have sort of a second purpose, because I wrote this before Donald Trump became our president. And my post-Trump purpose is to try and find solutions and to speak to depressed audiences and get them active. That's my second purpose.
So one of the things, well, first of all, I want to just say right straight away, I refuse to call that man my president. He's number 45 as far as I'm concerned. Let me just follow this up, and it just occurred to me just now when you just said, so you used ethnography, right, which I don't really, basically, you want to explain what ethnography is? I mean, we got a whole bunch of smart people here, but for those people who, haven't gone to grad school, can you explain that approach really quickly?
Yes. If you're an ethnographer and you're really interested in finding your best, deepest answers to something, what you do is begin by reading a lot of quantitative work, so you get a lay of the land.
You guys actually read our stuff?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Read my books, you'll find a lot of quant work there. But if you're a person like me, what you learn by getting up close to somebody, really up close, and getting to see how they feel about things, and that is how I learn. For me, each person is a book, as complex as a book, and as interesting, and so I have to get up close. It's not everybody's like that, but that's how I am, and ethnographers are. And so you try and climb into their life. And what I did, for example, I'll give you an example.
Okay.
Once I had this red state paradox in mind of how the poor states and the worst off states in every possible way, lowest life expectancy, everything, take more money from the federal government than in aid than they give to it in tax dollars and revile the federal government. I went in with my question, and that was it. And Louisiana, which was this heartland of the South, I thought, okay, perfect. This is just where this is the strongest, so I'll go there. And then it turns out to be Lake Charles in the Southwest is a petrochemical center, chemical industry where the pollution is the 1% worst of the entire country, very second highest cancer rate in the country. And they don't believe in regulating polluters. So I thought, with my alarm system off, perfect. This is what I don't get. So with that in mind, here's how ethnography worked. I had five different strategies for getting around about over those 5 years, but one of them was to go to meetings of the Republican women of Southwest Louisiana. And they have a gun raffle. So start with a prayer and the pledge, gun raffle. And then we're eating our gumbo. I knew I wasn't in Berkeley, California. And so you're sitting around with eight people, women, and one of them said, Madonna, her name was, I love Rush Limbaugh. Mm. So I had my little empathy wall moment. I thought, holy shit. And oh, I really love to talk to you about that. And so, should we meet for sweet teas? Yeah, so tomorrow, sweet teas, we're meeting. And she's explaining to this. I explained to everybody, look, I'm Mary Poppins. I've dropped out of the sky from Berkeley, California. Berkeley. Oh, you communist? and I would say, and I'm worried about the divide. You'd get a head nod, okay, the divide. And then, and I feel like I'm in one bubble, but you're in another, and so I'm here to write a book about your bubble. And people say, okay, y'all come, okay. You set them straight. You know, your people don't understand us, and they think we're all backward and prejudiced, and you set them straight. That's all right, what I... No promises, but all right. But So I meet Madonna, and I ask her, well, so what is it about Rush Limbaugh that you like? And, oh, he is my brave heart. So, about what? Oh, he hates feminazis. And I thought, I hope she hasn't Googled me. Second shift. and so I'm listening, and I'll ask her, well, what is a feminazi? Oh, it's a hard, cold, tough, you know, hates her kids, me first kind of person. I thought, whoa, I don't like that kind of person either. And actually, privately, I thought it's a little like Ayn Rand and these iconic books of the right. But so I'm listening, and well, what else do you like about him? Oh, he hates these environmental wackos. Well, what's an environmental wacko? So I'm like that, you know. And then she said, I know you don't agree with me. Mm. Is it hard for you to hear what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh, she's watching. And I said, actually, to tell you the truth, it's not hard. I have my alarm system off. Mm-hmm. I'm not here to tell you about me. I'm here to learn about you, and you are really doing me an enormous favor, for which I'm very grateful. And I'm learning a lot. I'm already learning a lot. And then she said, oh, I do that too. I do that with my kids. I can turn my alarm system off. And I do that with my parishioners. She turned out to be the wife. She's a gospel singer in a Pentecostal church, and her husband, mega church, 700 parishioners, and he was the minister. And so she said, I do that. And so we, okay, so you know what I'm doing here. And then she said, you know why I really like Rush Limbaugh? I said, you know what? Really, the truth is, he protects me against people like you who think that we're backward and stupid and racist, sexist, homophobic, and fat. She was a large woman. But she was an extraordinary singer. She invited me to her church, and at the service, her husband, there was on a Thursday, the plants empty out on a Thursday around 7 o'clock, so they waited till 7:05, and all these parishioners that had been, their workers in the Sasol and Phillips 66 and are sitting there. And her husband said, oh, we have with us today Arlie Hosh, who's come to find out how we Southerners think. Mm-hmm. And then I thought, my 700 people, you want to have an ethnographic sort of luck is what it was. They came up, oh. People say, oh, are your folks anywhere near Stockton? You know, we get in our camper truck and visit kin. So a lot of people, that was one way that I did it. But that's how I learn is close up.
Thank you. So another question I want to ask, about two concepts that you introduce in your book, keyholes and line cutting. So can you please elaborate on what is a keyhole in this context? And why you chose environmentalism as a, because I can think about several other keyhole issues, if you will. So why
for
environmentalism
sure.
as your keyhole issue?
Because I was, I had read What's the Matter with Kansas, and the whole issue of self-interest came up. Is this really, the candidates that you're voting for, is it in your self-interest to do it? Well, that interested me, and in a pragmatic way, I thought, okay, this would be a way to find, this way to reach people, actually. I could get them that we might not agree on other things. Mm-hmm. We won't agree on race, but I get them this way.
Right.
So in a way, I was, and in a conversation, you know, don't you want to live long? You know, becomes quite a basic question. How could you be, I know you love hunting and you love fishing and you love nature and you love your children and your kin and they're dying. That's why I chose that. You could say there's some pragmatism.
Because I wanted to ask you, because clearly like race would be the obvious keyhole issue.
Yeah, but I thought, oh, I'd get knocked back. I didn't think so.
Okay, so you thought you would get a better reception by approaching it through the environment.
Not just reception, but I thought that they could maybe see it my way. on that issue. I mean, so as a starter issue, you could say there's some pragmatism. It was a starter issue.
Okay, because that was the first thing I thought. I'm like, in the environment, like, I'm thinking, like, given everything that's going on, especially based on the research that Matt and I did on the Tea Party, like, you know, race was a huge part of it, but it wasn't just limited to race. It was sexism, xenophobia, all these other things. But we're going to get to that in a few moments. Right now, with the line-cutting metaphor.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. I listened to them talk, and I thought, what do I have here? There's a stack of attitudes that people are telling me, and I'm absorbing. And as an ethnographer, what you are is really a sponge. And then you go home and you try and put it together and think, okay, what's this adding up to? And what, for me, the basic approach was feelings. What are people's feelings attached to? How do you form a symbol? What is a symbol? When do things really feel hot and bothered? And when do you feel like that's you that's been destroyed or you that's been elevated? Mm-hmm. I got very interested in feelings, and all my work has had that as a kind of a focus. I'm a social psychologist, really. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, actually, underlying those attitudes is a deep story. And they've got theirs, and I think we've got ours. But the deep story, what is a deep story? You take facts clean on out of the deep story. You take moral ideas out of the deep story. It's just what's left. It's what feels true about a salient situation. So what is their deep story? What do they feel about something really important? And what came up was that they felt, and you tell it like a dream, you know, or in a language of metaphor, that you're waiting in line as in a pilgrimage, and you face the top of the hill is the American dream, and you feel like you deserve that dream, that you worked hard for it, and you actually feel that you don't begrudge anybody. Isn't that interesting? Just pause on that one. I'm taking you inside a
you're taking me inside Southern white people's heads right now? Is that
that's just what I'm doing. Yes, yes. Well, but pause for a bit.
Okay.
That's just what I'm doing. You can come right on back.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's uncomfortable.
Yes, yes, yes. But the feeling is of innocence. It's important for us to know this, I think. We're really going to be effective in this political moment. Mm. I mean, we have really lost big time. This is so serious. Mm-hmm. And we have to know, I think, what we're dealing with. Mm-hmm. And so, deep story is a sense of, gosh, the American dream is there. And they hadn't had a raise in 2 decades, and so the line wasn't moving. And then in another moment of this deep story, they're line cutters. Well, who are they? They're blacks who, through federally mandated affirmative action, I was on the affirmative action committee at UC Berkeley, by the way, and am a beneficiary of it. So blacks and then women, even worse, 51% of the population are, so blacks now have access to jobs that have been historically reserved for whites, and women who now have access to jobs historically reserved for men, and then immigrants, undocumented, and for them, even the oil-soaked brown pelican, Louisiana's state bird, you know, goes waddling up and sort of, it's cutting in line. And they said, oh, the environmentalists put animals ahead of people. They're animists, you know, worship animals. So, and refugees, you know, seen as cutting in. And then another moment of the deep story, and here's where I think your book is really important here. Barack Obama seems to be waving to the line cutters. Oh, he's their president. Oh, he's the president of the line cutters. In fact, isn't he a line cutter himself? Many people told me over and over again, how did his mother, a single mother, afford a Harvard education, afford a Columbia education? I could never do, nobody I know could. must be rigged. So then it goes, you know, no such thing as scholarships for brilliant students. They go to a rigging place. And then, then they began to feel, well, who am I? I'm never going to get ahead. They're not looking in the back of the line. You know, they're just looking forward. And no history, too. There's an erasure of history. And then they feel a kind of final moment of the right-wing deep story that someone from the West Coast, let's say, someone highly educated, let's say, someone like me, let's say, or you, I'd say, turns around, they're closer to the American dream, but turns around and says, you ignorant, Bible-thumping, ill-educated, redneck. And for them, that word is the ultimate insult, you know. I worked hard and so on. So that is the right-wing deep story. Mm-hmm. And it's as uncomfortable as it is, I think it's important to kind of just see what that feels like and then to see how the distrust of the government derives from that.
So you would say then that the distrust of the government sort of goes through this idea that they're hard-earned tax money is being redistributed to people. Can I make that inference, at least, that that's part of their problem?
Yes, that's okay. Right. That's okay. Right. By the way, after doing sort of developing this deep story, I went back to people. People say, oh, you read my mind. Yeah. Oh, I live your metaphor. And others then would say, no, you don't have it quite right. Because the line waiters, the waiters in line are paying taxes to support the people who are cutting in line, and the government has been the author of this. So it's kind of affirmative action gone amok, mm-hmm. is a short version.
So two things. So what were your findings ultimately? Like, what did you ultimately conclude? And beyond that, were there any surprises?
Oh, wow. Well, let's think. The deep story was a discovery for me. I didn't know they felt that way. Mm. I didn't know why they felt the way they did. But so.
Wait a second. Let me press you on that. Uh-huh. Did that change the way you felt about the people or the types of people you interviewed? Did you go down there with one? So we all kind of know what it's like to be a social scientist. One has to be objective, right? But when you are conducting these interviews, I mean, you're a human being, right? So you're sitting there in front of these people and you're hearing their story. So I would think at some level, you know, some emotion, as hard as you may have tried, you know, had to register. And maybe, and sometimes it was empathy, sometimes maybe it was disdain,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
But I guess what I'm trying to, ask is did you go down there with one sort of frame of mind, right? And when you returned to Berkeley, it wasn't the same.
Wow, that's a really deep question. Doing this work was hard, and there were times I thought, I can't talk to this person. That there's one person that's not in the book, I just couldn't manage it. Racist. Mm-hmm. And I thought, I can't climb the empathy well here. Mm-hmm. I can't do it. And one part toward the end of this research, Donald Trump came for the primary rally in New Orleans, mm-hmm. and I went to that rally with a Tea Party mm-hmm. member, mm-hmm. and it was 6 hours in the car. And, you know, where she was talking at me, mm-hmm. because, you know how some people don't want to have their views challenged? And so they fill it up with words, you know, like cement. And so I had to receive words for 6 hours. Mm-hmm. It was hard. It's not easy, all fun, nice people. They are, some of them, capable of great empathy and maturity themselves and complexity. Yeah. That was, you asked for surprises. I didn't expect that. And so, you know, I developed emotional respect for certain of them, very much so. But this woman, that was, so it calls on your capacity to be patient. But toward the very end, I have to say I had a flight reaction. I was staying with one of them, and I just couldn't get out fast enough. Once I saw Trump, I thought, oh man, I'm in deeper than I thought. Whoa. Yeah.
And we're going to get to Trump here in a few moments. I know that's what one of the things a lot of people came to hear, like, how does this feed into the current political moment? And I just want to alert you guys as an audience. So we're supposed to have a 45-minute conversation. We're getting ready to bump up against that real soon. And so the balance of that was supposed to be devoted to Q&A. I just want to let you know I'm cutting into your Q&A time probably, okay? just want to let you know. It'll go from 30 to maybe 20 minutes. So. All right. So the last thing on this first bank of questions I want to ask is, where does race fit into the deep story?
Oh, big time. I think it is really at the basis of the deep story. That is the first line cutter. And it was so interesting. Race was all over the place, just physically. I mean, if you just looked at the names of, you know, of the parishes and the banks and the freeways, and actually in one of the people that I met, who was an environmentalist, and I had asked him, he said, oh, I have a lot of friends who hate what I do. I said, can I follow you around and meet the people who hate what you do? Which was really, it took me into central Louisiana. He lived in the back of beyond in the woods in Longville. And he said in 2010, there was a cross burning. 2010, not that long ago in Longville. There were some road workers, there was road repair, and they wanted to, they had a camper truck or a unit that they sat down that on the ground to live in while they were there, so they wouldn't have to commute. And there was this burning, and federal troops came out and arrested the men, six men. So, yeah, race is really there. It isn't, see, one of the surprises, too, is that it wasn't race as I expected it, though. There were some surprises to it. I was a civil rights worker in 1962. This is before you were born, I guess. And in Vicksburg, Mississippi, my husband and myself. And that was a difficult year. There were three civil rights workers murdered that year. And then it was just so blatant and just so clear. And people would yell epithets at the house where we stayed, nigger lover, and so on. So I never encountered those whites there. I was working with blacks, and but I got a sense of the intractability of this and the clarity, as I imagined, in their minds of this. But when I, this is what's interesting about Charlottesville. I went back after Charlottesville to say, let me check out race. What's the deal here? And what was really fascinating is that after these events of the KKK with the torches and the Nazis and the murder, all of that. We then saw our president say there were good people on both sides, and then we saw this master tweeter spend 48 hours without tweets, tweetless 2 days before he responded to the uproar that his first inadequate response led to. So we are in the hands of clearly a racist president. So I went back. What did you think, I would say, of Charlottesville? And the answers were that big grimace. Oh, it's terrible. They should, they're mean people. They should, they're awful people. This, no. What did you think about the president's response? He's good. You know, we like Trump. But, like that. So I thought, well, this is interesting. Mm-hmm. Okay, surprise one, that you have a racist president who is dog whistling to his, quote, racist base. I am talking to the racist base, and they are saying, no, this sullies our cause. This demeans us. We don't want to be associated with those racists. So I think, oh, this is not like 1964, Freedom Summer, very different. But this is how it gets complicated. I said, well, oh, so you don't, you're like, no, terrible. Because it sullies the American flag to have white nationalists. We think they're terrible. And it sullies, surprise, to the Confederate flag. So I go, whoa, this is dizzy, you know. And that's what this work is like. There's one surprise after another. So what did that mean? Well, then you would get a story about, well, the Confederate flag, that's not associated with slavery. We love Martin Luther King, we hate slavery, but the Confederate flag just represents the South. And then I'd say, represents the South, okay. Often one of my strategies was just to repeat what the last thing they said, as if ingenue, I don't quite get it. And they would say, yes. And then there, with a lot of them, there was a flurry about the different kinds of Confederate flag.
Different kinds of Confederate flag?
There are different kinds of Confederate flag. There's early Confederate flag and a late Confederate flag. There's the they said, a battle flag and a non-battle flag. There were a plethora of flags. So I thought, what's going on here? It was an attempt, my interpretation, to cleanse the idea of their history of the South, and they would, so it was as if racism, as I had understood it, had kind of, it was, you put an anticoagulant in the cultural bloodstream of the South, and these things that I thought cohered and were solid, you either were or you won't, they had divided them into little narratives, each with its emotional punchline, like, oh, I didn't, you know, my family was just poor whites. We never owned slaves. Well, what is that? Why are they telling me that? What? They're telling me that because they don't want me to guilt trip, as they think all liberals do. So, and that would be the same person who, didn't like the white nationalists, didn't want to be associated with them. So I guess what I learned, you asked what the surprises were. The surprises is I didn't expect it to come in this form. They are for Trump, and they are threatened by black line cutters and women line cutters. So putting it all together, you can say, yes, this is racism, but it certainly didn't feel anything like what I expected based on my 64 exposure.
So in your afterword, however, that's not. When is your new paperback edition going to be published?
Just out. It's just coming out.
So it's out there?
Yeah.
So your afterword that you sent me is in that book?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So the question I wanted to ask is that, you know, I read the afterword, and, you know, they were, I know what you're saying here, but they were a little more explicit. I mean, I drew the conclusion that, you know what, these people are kind of racist, right? Well, not even kind of. I'm saying that right now. Yeah. But if I were in private with folks, But I'm saying the conclusion I drew, these are straight up racists. They're trying to rationalize, as you just said.
Yes.
But I still, one can draw the conclusion, however, mm-hmm. that these people are racist, right? And so, and that's kind of what I drew from reading your afterword, but that's not what you're saying right now. So can you reconcile these two things?
I'm saying it's racism in a new form. It's and that they care what the rest of society thinks. When I was there in 1964, I don't think they cared at all. Now there's this effort to say, no, I'm not a racist. They were terribly afraid that...
Well, so they wouldn't believe in what we call a social scientist, or they wouldn't admit to what's called old-fashioned racism. It's kind of stereotypical racism, but it's more consistent with what scholars have been talking about for 30 years, a sort of new racism, the fact that their belief that black folks, you know, violate cherished American values, hard work, individualism, and all those things. Would you say it would fit within that framework?
Yeah, I would. Okay. New.
Okay,
yeah.
New racism. Okay. So, well, I got to skip past a whole bunch of questions, so let's get to this here. So one question I want to ask is that, you know, we had this discussion in the green room, and also when I read the book, when I read the first part of your book, and most people that know me know I fucking hate the economic anxiety argument. Can't stand it, right? Because it just doesn't work, right? That dog won't hunt. That dog is dead, right? So, and the reason why I say that, thank you, and the reason why I say that is that Matt and I found that in our, you know, our Tea Party book, that this sort of perception of economic anxiety failed to impact at all their support for the Tea Party. And then when we move forward to Trump, right? So this idea that, you know, Trump won because of working class whites. I mean, I think all of us kind of figured that out now, that that's not the case. You know, how can one say that, you know, he benefited from, you know, the working class whites made the difference when, it, as a matter of fact, he won 48% of college educated whites. Now, I'm not saying that some of them aren't economically anxious, but come on, let's keep it real here, right? College educated whites, I don't think that they're economically anxious. And even in the green room, you were telling me that you were dealing with the, what'd you say, the elite of the...
The elite of the left behind.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And you know, when you think about who the movement, who are the people that start movements on the left or right, they aren't the abjectly poor often.
Right.
They're
right.
One up from that.
Right.
And
that's
who these people are.
That's right. That is totally right about that. But one of the questions I also want to ask is, and this will get to the point at which we're talking about, how do we move forward, right? And what's the solution here, if there is one? So how do these people differ from, I mean, are all conservatives the same? Like, I mean, are these people all of a piece with, you know, conservatism as we know it? Or can we sort of separate these folks out? Because when we were talking about possible solutions and we agreed on this, I didn't think we would, but we did. And it's like there's about 20, 25%, probably even 30% now that Trump is in office that will not budge, right? They are not willing to compromise, right? They are these what are called, what Hofstadter called back in the day, and I wanted to ask you about the paranoid style, but we're not going to have time, that the late Richard Hofstadter, this historian at Columbia, wrote this very famous book, among his other famous books, called The Paranoid Style in American Politics, and he's talking about essentially what we're talking about right now. And one of the things he said was, like most people think about fundamentalism, they associate it with religion of some kind, right? It doesn't have to be associated with religion. Fundamentalism is just strictly an old school way of looking at anything, right? Fundamentals of football, baseball, basketball, right? It's a very old school way of looking at things. So he called these people secular fundamentalists. And I tend to think that these are the same kind of people. So, and in our research, Matt and I's research and continuing research, what we find is that an establishment conservative will tolerate change, right? As long as a change is somewhat productive. You know, they will embrace social change if it is productive, right? But they won't. But they'll embrace it only to the extent that it won't lead to revolution, right? So they prefer evolutionary, slow, organic change to revolutionary change. That's one of the reasons that, you know, that's one of the things that Edmund Burke wrote about way back in the day on the French Revolution. If the ancient regime had made some concessions, they wouldn't have got this revolution. And so I think present-day establishment conservatives kind of feel the same way, whereas these establishment types have, these reactionary types have a more Manichaean worldview. It's good versus evil. That's why it's so difficult for them to compromise. They see compromise as capitulation to evil, right? And so what I thought when I read your book, these are the same people that I'm seeing, right? Now, and that's a question. That actually should be a question. I should have problematized that, right? So do you see those kind of people in your interview subjects?
I see both. I would say some were Manichaean, as you describe, and I thought, whoa, this will be very hard to make any common ground on issues. And we should understand who they are, but move on, right? That it wouldn't be productive use of our scarce, precious political time. There was, for example, at the Trump rally, there was a man who said to nobody in particular, there are thousands of people, and they're a big rally, very excited, and he said, "Oh, to be in the presence of such a man."
Wow.
So there, I felt, and I've written about this elsewhere, op-ed in the Boston Globe, that really, while Trump has violated virtually every moral precept of the religious right, he tapped into a kind of belief in the rapture. Mm-hmm. You can do that. That's the paradox. Mm-hmm. And this man saw him as being raised up in a secular rapture.
Oh, wow.
So so you're not going to have a crossover talk with that guy.
Okay, right. Which leads into this, my penultimate question. Will these kinds of people always be around in your estimation, right? And so answer that question first, and then the follow-up is, where do we go from here? Like, what if anything is a solution?
Okay. Yes, maybe there will always be such people, but I think it's a huge mistake for us to say, Trump is a racist. Yes, Trump is a racist, but all of the people that voted for him are also racist and deplorable people. I think that's a big mistake. Because, and your own work, I think, would bear this out, there are different types of people. These break down into different types. So where I think we go from here is this. We, I think, should get out of our depression and our confusion, get active, because we are faced with a moment so momentous that it's hard to know what to compare it with. The Civil War itself, I think, is really serious, and we have to devote time and attention to this, all of us as good citizens. It's my own personal belief. And that there are four important pillars of activism. The first, in lots of different ways, address ourselves to the importance and defense of the principle of democracy, checks and balances. I think that these pillars are being kicked at, the whole independence of the press and the independence and legitimacy of a judicial system. So that's the first thing. You don't need to talk to anyone you don't agree with in doing that. Second is to reformulate the Democratic platform and to get candidates, really, that speak to the issues that are on a lot of people's minds, and and make people feel acknowledged and be the party of the unifier, you know, and be the party of patriotism, actually, and the Constitution. Why can't the Democratic Party, the party of the working man and the working woman, be the party of unity and democracy? I would love to see that. That's pillar two. Again, you don't have to talk to anybody that feels they're being taken up to heaven and so on. Pillar three is to get the vote out, and your own work on that shows that voter turnout is enormous. So pillar three, and again, don't have to talk to people that aren't like you. But pillar four, and these are in order of importance in my view.
Okay.
One, two, three come first. But in addition, I think, and coordinated with the first three pillars, we need a fourth pillar that will help us actually with the first three, which is to reach out to certain subgroups in the Trump camp. And I think of what is by some estimates 6 million and by other estimates 8.5 million people who voted for Barack Obama in 2012 and then switched to Trump in 2016. I think you could have some very good conversations with this group, and it'd be a mistake to smear them and sneer and say, oh, well, you voted for him, I'm giving up on you. Mm-hmm. And the one out of three, you would know this better than I, but it's either a quarter to a third of white voters who voted for Trump but would have voted for Bernie Sanders if he had been the candidate. I found a lot of liking of Sanders among these super right-wingers. Wouldn't that be an interesting conversation? So I think pillar four can strengthen the work going on in pillar one, two, and three, and we need to be coordinated as in a loyal opposition until the next time we get to vote.
Thank you for streaming this episode of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Arlie Russell Hochschild is the author of Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning on the American Right. She spoke with University of Washington political science professor Christopher Sebastian Parker on February 12th at Seattle University's Piggott Auditorium as part of Town Hall Seattle's Civics Series. Thank you to KUOW's Sonia Harris for our recording. You can hear the full event on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. Stay current with us by subscribing to our podcast. Tune in again soon.